What's up, everybody, and welcome back to the Stretch 4 podcast. I'm your host, Peter Tran, and on the line, I got my not-so-much pick-and-pop partner these days, Josh Cohen. How you doing?
I'm pumped up. Like, I just won a three-peat. Man, I'm excited right now.
Wow, did the Raptors three-peat already?
No, we're back-to-back champions right now, baby.
Back-to-back. Iso Raj, man, how you feeling?
Not as pumped as Josh, but you know what? Great weather, great show. I'm just ready to jump right into it.
How's the weather in Ottawa these days?
Oh my God, it's so nice today. I might just violate every single bylaw and just go out and play some basketball today anyway. Give me that $800 fine. I don't care.
It's $880 though.
Whatever. I'm good with
that. Wow, this guy, you're going to fork over almost a grand just like that? Just get some shots
off? I'll just run from the bylaw. They can't catch me anyway.
Yeah, that's true. You got that John Stockton speed.
That's right.
All right, so we're here. We're back. The last episode of the Traveling Cocaine Circus has arrived. And guys, this was it was pretty much everything we wanted out of the doc. This was clearly a Jordan documentary because, you know, there was very little shit talking about Mike. Let's be real. What'd you guys see out of episode 9? So episode 9, we got the 97 finals. You got the flu game. You got game 7 against Indy in 98. What were your takeaways? Josh, why don't you start?
The series against Indiana was, you know, obviously they talked about it and being one of the closest series that they played. Obviously, it went 7 games, and they probably should have lost that game if it wasn't for, you know, little things that happened at the end of the game, and obviously Steve Kerr coming up clutch. So that series is really interesting to watch it. I watched it, like, years ago, and just to see how Indiana just beat them up inside. But in Game 7, the biggest thing that sort of changed was the Bulls' offensive rebounding in that game. But seeing how close they were to defeat was really interesting to see again.
The offensive rebounding is a major point here, right? Because you're looking at a team with Rick Smits, who's 7'4", and then you got Antonio and Dale Davis, who are both just a beast inside. And then realistically, who are the rebounders for the Bulls outside of Rodman? You know what I mean? Like, they're pretty undersized.
The issue was, though, the backcourt, right? Because those guys are all 6'6 plus in the starting lineup with, you know, Harper, MJ, and Pippen. So whoever had, you know, Mark Jackson or Reggie Miller on them could just bully them, basically, and get those little tip-out rebounds.
And that's what we saw, right? I think I saw somewhere that Mike had, I think, 4 offensive rebounds in this game alone.
Yeah, I think the Bulls had 40% offensive rebounding rate in that game, which is insane.
That's ridiculous. I want to ask you both this question. So obviously there's a lot of talk about how, you know, Mike's shot, the last shot against Byron Russell in game 6 of 98 was a push off. Whatever, we'll get to that later. Was the push from Reggie Miller a foul in game 4 when he's curling off that screen and he said, and like, he basically explained it that he just ran into Mike to get that space, right? Was that a foul?
Reggie Miller's push off was way worse than Michael's supposed push off.
Yeah, I agree there. Like, I can see Reggie Miller extend his arms a little. It wasn't like he pushed him like hard, but enough to create separation. So that's a foul.
Is that a foul in the last couple of seconds of a tight game, though?
Hell no.
Of a playoff game?
Hell no.
Well, they would have called that if it was in Chicago. Let's be realistic here.
I think they would have called it if it seemed like the Bulls might have lost. Like, they lost the series, you know what I mean?
If you were in a quarantine setting in Las Vegas or Disney World and that happened, that's a foul.
What? What does that even mean?
I'm saying if you're in a neutral setting, that is a foul every time. But if, since you're in Indiana and, you know, if you call a foul in that situation, you may not make it out alive, they decided to let it go.
I don't know, man. I think it was bad, but I don't think it was worth calling a foul over.
Yeah, especially not late in the game. And I think Reggie Miller knew that going into the play, and he knew that he could afford to do that and like get that little bit of separation and the refs wouldn't call it. So good on him for taking advantage of the leniency of the refs in the last seconds of the game.
Yeah, you gotta take full advantage, right? I mean, you're going against Mike. You gotta take every little advantage you can take that you can take. Why wouldn't you?
That play is a definition of a push off. That was full two arms extended push off, right?
Was
there.
It extended? I don't think it was fully extended.
Yes, it was.
I don't know. Why don't you guys talk about it? I'm going to rewatch this again just so I can fight back with you. Because I don't remember it being full extension.
Like, Michael did not flop on that play. Michael went back at least 2 feet, and then Reggie was able to curl and then get to the wing and able to hit that fadeaway shot. And Michael was, like, almost at half court when the initial push happened. So that was a full push off.
Yeah, and also the momentum that Reggie Miller had, like, he was running towards the top of the key, and he saw Michael there, and he had a head of steam. So he didn't have to fully extend 100%, but he got almost there and enough to push Michael back a few feet and create that separation, which he needed to hit that game-winning shot.
And although I really dislike Reggie and his really nasally voice and his awful commentary, I gotta say, I did enjoy watching him twirl around like a 3-year-old girl that just got her, you know, birthday present.
Yeah, the best part was looking at Larry Bird after that, just like stone-faced, doesn't even care. 0.7 seconds left. He's like, nah, man, Mike's still in this. We're not doing this right now. That's great. I love that. Cannot mess around with Larry Legend.
And yeah, and speaking about that episode, I know this is probably something that's a mute point, but I felt that some point in the episode, I was watching like a TNT former broadcast documentary, because like there was a huge side story about Reggie Miller, a huge side story about Steve Kerr, and obviously, they played important roles in that 98 series for different reasons, but it was a good thing to see Steve Kerr's story. I could have done without seeing so much Reggie Miller, but I guess he had to play the villain.
Do you think after Jordan beat them, Mark Jackson went, "Mama, there goes that man"?
No, oh God, you're terrible.
I had to, man. It was too easy. You always got to take shots at Mark Jackson.
I think he was questioning his religion at that point.
Maybe that's when he found religion. He found Black Jesus.
That's true. He prays to Michael.
Yeah. Yo, also, Mike calling himself Black Jesus is that's so badass.
That's when you know you're big time.
Referring to yourself as Black Jesus.
Or just referring to yourself in the third person is like one level, but as Black Jesus, that's like another level above that.
Yeah, he's transcended just being cocky, is what you're saying.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so let's move on. You go to, I think this is like a small part of this conversation, but I don't know. I think they could have talked about this more. So remember when Mike said that, you know, he had just retired, and then you had Malone and Stockton coming into Chicago to practice at the facility. And so, you know, Mike being the guy he is goes to say hi. And then Brian Russell comes up and talks shit about him retiring, saying that he could have guarded him the whole time. How quickly do you think Jordan was like, man, I'm going to watch this guy and just demolish him someday? Because you're talking shit to this one random dude who you've never seen in your life or never talked to in your life. And as Jordan, you're like, this is just some random rookie coming up to me saying that he can guard me when I just retired from the game? Nah, man. I feel like Mike probably went home, found game tape of Russell and just watched it for the next 5 years until he had the opportunity to like crush him.
Yeah, I think honestly, Michael just knew in the back of the head, like, this guy's crazy. Like, I don't even think he thought that much of it. But again, it's like typical Michael Jordan fashion that if you didn't know before, you definitely know after watching this documentary that he made everything personal. Like, he had personal vendettas over every single player, coach, journalist, even probably his father at a certain point. He made everything personal, and it made it pretty much his life mission to prove people wrong.
I feel like that whole situation just never happened.
It's a LeBradford Smith situation all over again.
It honestly could be.
I think so. I bet you if they asked Malone, he'd have no idea what the hell he was talking about. And I'm sort of disappointed that Russell wasn't interviewed for this, or he declined an interview for this to see what his point of view on everything was.
He probably denied it. Including the push-off. He probably denied it. Let's be real. What, like?
Yeah, but I mean, you have John Stockton and Karl Malone, the two superstars of the team, taking part in the documentary, and you as a role player, a 3-and-D guy, who got torched by MJ, can't take part in it? Come on.
Yeah, but I don't think
Malone didn't take part.
Yeah, Malone wasn't in there.
It was only Stockton from the Jazz.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
No.
And Stockton didn't really say much. He basically just said, yeah, I respected Mike, but I wasn't scared of him. I mean, that's what every other player said in this doc, unless you were on the Bulls. It's, yeah, I respected the guy, but like, I'm not turning down from the guy. I'm not scared of him.
I guess the one part that stood out with me with Malone, I think it was in the second episode, but just the fact that he went on the Chicago Bulls team bus after they won the championship and congratulated everyone. And MJ's like, yeah, you know, say hello to your wife for me. That was odd, but it was interesting.
Why is that weird? What are you implying, Josh?
Do you think that anybody nowadays would be doing that? I don't know. I just, even back then, it sort of seems like, you know, taboo to be, you know, a player that just lost the, you know, game six championship. Where a lot of people are blaming you for what happened, obviously, and choking in the last minute, I should say. And then you go on the team bus and congratulate everyone. It just seems like an odd thing to do.
He's a classy guy.
Yeah, I think it just showed his class, if anything, and he wasn't doing...
Okay, let's get real. Karl Malone has no class. Do we have to go back into his past and talk about the 14-year-old Mexican girls? Like, come on.
No, I don't want to do that. That's too much, man. Let's leave Karl Malone's past out of here. Can we move on to the flu game here? Because obviously we need to talk about the now known food poisoning game and not the flu game.
Pizza game.
I have a question. Why are there five dudes delivering a pizza to one person? How could that be a thing?
How do they know it's him too?
That was my second question. When you're checking in, obviously everyone knows that the Bulls are staying at the Marriott. That's fine. But you should be using aliases when you're delivering food or when you're checking in, right? Or if you're ordering a pizza on a Sunday night, bro, I would say I was Scott Burrell or Steve Kerr. Why are you saying this is Michael Jordan's room? I don't understand.
You know, I would pay for the footage to see these guys watching that game and them arguing with each other, telling each other, you know, why didn't you put more poison in that pizza? Or why didn't you put more of whatever they put on that pizza in that pizza? It clearly wasn't working.
Why didn't you put more poison?
Poison, yeah. I would have loved to actually see someone come out and be like, yeah, I was that pizza delivery guy. Like, yes, we did poison it. Or like, no, we didn't. And I would just love to hear their perspective. Maybe not on the documentary, obviously, but like, it's been a day now. And I'm sure the four or five people, there's at least someone who's alive and remembers the story.
Yeah, you didn't rub it up against the floor enough. Come on.
Yeah, I want to know how they poisoned it. Like, what did they use? Was it just sprinkling some random stuff on? Was it like expired meat or like vegetables? Old dough? You know what I mean? Like there could be a variety of things that you could do to give someone food poisoning. Maybe they just sneezed on it a bunch of times.
Do you think they were trying to kill MJ and MJ's just too strong?
Well, he's Black Jesus.
I could see it. Utah fans are crazy. I think they established that.
Yeah, that was the other part. This is going into episode 10, but you know when they finally brought in MJ's kids for like... that like 2 minute span?
Yeah.
Yeah, they were like, oh yeah, did you get to go to Utah? All of them were like, nah, mom thought it was a bad idea for us to go to Utah.
Yeah, and it was funny too, because you could probably tell that MJ was like, you know what, I gotta throw my kids somewhere, like in the documentary, like let's just throw them right at the end.
Some pity points in the very last episode.
I'm surprised they didn't just come out and say, oh yeah, white people be crazy, we're not going to Utah.
I think that was the implication, though, no?
Yeah,
they should have just outright said it. I mean, everything else has been said in black and white. You might as well just come out and say it.
Yo, but people in Utah buy Jordans, too, you know?
That's true.
Good point.
Didn't you spot all the Jordan jerseys in those photos? There was a few, man.
Yeah, they're mostly on kids, though, because not too many people were crazy enough to wear Bulls jerseys in that time.
That's true.
That's like going to a Philadelphia Eagles game back in the day and you're wearing an opposing team's jersey. You're just asking for it. Or like a Red Wings game in hockey.
Yeah.
Back in the 90s.
Raj, would you have done such a thing to an Eagles game?
Well, obviously I'm an Eagles fan, so how would I dare wear another jersey? But
would you egg somebody if you saw them in like a Bills jersey at an Eagles game?
You know what? I'm not afraid of the Bills, so I wouldn't say anything. I think that's punishment enough. But another team, like the Cowboys, hell fucking yeah.
Ooh. Feisty, Raj.
Yeah, but I just wanted to add to the point about like Utah and the flu game or the food poisoning game. It was funny how they just like kind of brushed over the series a bit. Like they're like, oh, and they just moved right away to game five.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't much about that series from what I recall, right? Like the flu game and then the Steve Kerr shot were the two biggest takeaways from that. And I think they were trying to focus more, because that was all in episode 9, right? So I think they were trying to focus more on... like the Indiana series from 98 more so than anything else, because that was the toughest series according to like most of the guys on this team that they went through in like 3 years.
I just found it funny how like the finals that year wasn't as memorable. It was more the the Jordan storylines and obviously Steve Kerr. And I'm not sure if we're going to talk more about him, but I didn't know all the details about Steve Kerr's past. And it seemed like he's honestly made a very good career, winning four straight championships as a player and winning three as a coach. He's going to go down in Basketball Hall of Fame as one of the better personnel people in the NBA and obviously player as well. So just kind of nice to see a bit of another player's perspective, and it makes sense why he made the front cover of The Last Dance.
I think he had two championships with the Spurs, right? Not one? 99 and 03, right after 98? I'm pretty sure he went there.
I remember his series against Dallas, I think it was in 03, where he had all those three-pointers in the fourth quarter to bring them back in game six, I believe.
Yeah.
But 2000, I don't think he was there in 2000.
In 99, you mean?
Or sorry, 99. Well, yeah, 99.
Yeah, no, he was.
He was.
Five-time champ, Steve Kerr. NBA three-point contest champion in 1997, Steve Kerr. How about that? It's a bad dude.
Great hair, too.
Really? You think so?
I like this haircut back in the day.
The crew cut? Nah, hard pass. His hair now looks better than then.
Yeah, debatable.
Okay. You want to talk about how Jordan keeps shitting on Scott Burrell no matter what, even when he's not in the room? Like, how are you going to take shots at this guy who can't even defend himself, telling Ahmad Rashad to stay away from him?
That was
shit out of him.
You stay away from Scott Burrell. You're not instructed to talk to Scott Burrell. You scare the shit out of him.
That was probably my favorite part of that episode, actually, just because it was the most subtle jab, but it was like worth $1 million. He's like, stay away from him or he's going to crack under the pressure.
Just some dude on your team, man. He's legitimately not in the room and we're just taking shots at him for no reason. What's up with this disrespect?
Yeah, poor Scott Burrell, man. But he took it well. He took it like a champ. Especially afterwards when they show the clip of those, like Pippen and Jordan in the locker room with Scott Burrell, and Jordan's still going after him, and Scott Burrell's just like laughing like crazy. And I think MJ eventually, you know, he sort of softened up. He had a soft spot for Burrell afterwards. You could see it.
Burrell seems like the nicest guy, man. Even for all of Jordan's shit talking, he's like, yeah, I'm going to see you. I'm going to party with you in LA, right? You can't leave me out of there. There's no way this man is.
You can kill him with kindness. Even Black Jesus will eventually warm up to you.
It's true. Do you know why Rick Smits went bald in that season in 98? Because every time I think of Rick Smits, I remember like a luscious head of hair on the dunking Dutchman. And then randomly, like I watched this game like a couple months back and was like, what the hell? I don't remember Rick Smits being bald.
I think it was so he's more aerodynamic.
So he can dunk more?
The Flying Dutchman, right?
Yeah, I guess so, but...
Or maybe that was his war cut.
Instead of a playoff beard, he's got a bald head.
Yeah, he's like Private Pyle from that movie from back in the 80s, except skinny and tall.
So obviously we're going to go Game 7 against Indy. Rick Smits, Jordan, jump ball. Up to now, it's obviously a really close game. And then I heard on a couple of different podcasts that Larry Bird kind of really choked this one away. Not in the sense that he was on the floor. Obviously, he was coaching for the first time, but he might have wanted to call a timeout before that jump ball because Rick Smits obviously won that tip, but tipped it straight to Pippen. I don't know, is that the kind of thing that you would expect your players to have a higher IQ of, to know where to tip the ball in that situation?
Yeah, let me just say this. They made too much of that whole situation. It's a jump ball. Like, I know it's one possession and they could have gone up five if they got the ball back, but they also could have just got a stop there and got the ball back.
Yeah, but it's still a pivotal point.
Yeah, but they're making it seem like, oh, if we won, like, especially Reggie, he's like, oh, if we win that jump ball, we probably win the game. It's like, come on, man, there's 7 minutes left in the game.
Was it that much time?
Yeah, it was 7 minutes.
Yeah, there's a lot of time left in that game.
Yeah,
I thought it was closer to like 3 or 4 minutes.
No, it was.
No, they made it seem like there was 1 minute left in the game, and then that caused a three-pointer, and then, you know, they had all the momentum going into the last three possessions of the game, but there was 7 minutes left.
Oh, well, you know, Reggie doesn't play defense, so he needs any stop he can get.
That's true.
I don't know. It looked like Mike, this is probably the most relief you ever see out of the guy out of the whole series, right? Like, in the locker room afterwards, he's going around to each player. Good job, you know, you showed up. Steve, Judd Buser, you guys did your thing.
Did you notice they almost caught Longley naked?
What?
Longley had to, like, put a towel on real quick when they panned over to him.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah.
No, I don't remember that at all, man.
Josh, you're watching way too attentively.
Damn. Longley, of all people, flashing the camera.
Another reason why Longley hates Jordan right there.
Because he almost got flashed.
Yeah.
Come on, man. No, but seriously, That must have been the most relief we've ever seen out of Jordan, because, you know, after like the Utah series the year before and in the in 98, it was more like, yeah, I did that. Like, what else did you expect from me? I'm Michael Jordan. But this one, that was like a huge weight was lifted off his shoulder after that Indiana series.
Yeah, and it was the first, the first game seven in what, 5 or 6 years since 92, 93. So it's different playing with the game seven pressure, because you know that if the ball bounces a few times against your way that you're eliminated. So despite Jordan being extremely clutch and hitting some big shots, game seven can really go either way. And it was a close contested game. And there are moments in the game where he probably thought like, oh shit, like Indiana has this, like this is how it's going to end.
Raj, have you ever seen anyone trash talk Larry Bird like that?
Was this after the game when Jordan was thanking Michael? Yeah. I found that to be just like a nice moment to see them backstage before they go into their respective press conferences. And I think Jordan can get away with it just because he beat Bird at when Bird was on a better team, and not beat him, but put up great stats. And obviously he was the key component of the Dream Team. So I think Bird respects a few players that are much better than him, and Jordan's definitely one of them.
Enjoy yourself, dog. You kids, fuck you. Y'all gave us the room for our money.
Yeah. I'll see you.
All right, take care. Thank you. Work on that golf game of yours.
Best trash talking there was. Any other notes from episode 9 before we move on? Although we've sort of been going back and forth already.
Sort of like they did.
Yeah, it's true. Yo, have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? When I was trying to get this podcast off the ground, I had a lot of questions. How do I record an episode? How do I get my show onto all the apps that people like to listen to? How do you make money? The answer was pretty simple for me. I started using Anchor. Anchor is a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing your podcast. And best of all, it's 100% free and super easy to use. And now, Anchor can match you with great sponsors who want to advertise in your podcast. So that means you can get paid immediately, like right away. In fact, that's what I'm doing right now by reading you this ad. Super simple. So if you always wanted to start a podcast, let's start now. Go to anchor.fm/start to join me and the diverse community of producers using Anchor. Again, that's anchor.fm/start. See you soon. All right, episode 10. Obviously, we're going fully into the 98 finals now. And my first question is, how is Michael Jordan jamming out so hard to a 90s R&B song on the bus? Like, you saw the way that guy was moving. It looked like he had something, like, bumping going on. And then find out it was Kenny Lattimore, of all people. Like, that is a smooth singing dude, and that's what Mike was, like, jamming out to. It was just strange.
Yeah, it was weird, too, because, like, you never saw that side of Michael at all in the documentary. Like, you always saw this killer side, and then you see him, like, kind of acting a bit goofy with the cameras and just saying like, hey, can I walk alone? Like, thanks guys. And like, obviously like just jamming out in pregame warmups. So it was just unique to see him, but I guess he had a bit of swag and he probably felt hella confident going into that series, considering they beat the Jazz the year before and they just overcame what he now describes as the biggest obstacle in his playoff run, the Indiana Pacers.
I like how they made it seem like MJ, when they showed like the practice runs, and him and a bunch of the role players off the bench were shooting those like around the half court shot line, and all of them were missing shots, and all of a sudden MJ gets up there and hits his first one, allegedly. Just little things like that just goes to show that, you know, obviously it's an MJ documentary, but the chance he just went up there and squished his first shot just adds to the aura of MJ when it probably took him like 10 shots.
Yeah, allegedly is very key here. There's no way that was his first shot. And it wasn't even that far, right? Like, they were shooting from the hash mark. So that's like probably 3 feet away from the line, 4 feet away from the line at most. If you look at guys now, that's easily where Steph and Trae Young pull up from further away.
Yeah, that's where Lillard hit a shot against OKC.
Yeah, and Lillard did it as like a sidestep or a step back. Killer. And these guys are like shooting from their hip, basically from their hips, to get an air ball. What a change in time.
Even Steve Kerr.
Yeah, he hit rim though, so that was good. I mean, he is one of the best shooters of all time for a reason. He can hit rim from anywhere. All right, moving on. You got Raj. Do you remember Rodzilla? Like, do you remember this being a thing?
No, I don't. I knew that the story was out, but I don't remember that he was with Hulk Hogan at the NWO. Like, no, I didn't know all those details. But again, that just added like, for me, value in the documentary, and I'm so happy they brought this up.
Josh, you remember Rodzilla?
I vaguely remember it because I was more of a WWF fan, but I would see highlights of like WCW shows and such. And the thing that caught me the most, which they didn't really show in this documentary, was how big Karl Malone was when Malone got into the ring with Dennis Rodman. Like, he was massive. Like, he looked like he was on the roids for sure.
Wow, man, the disrespect. Karl Malone looked like...
I mean, he was bigger than LeBron, man.
He looked like a roided up wrestler. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, most definitely.
Who had the betting who had the better wrestling career between those two?
Between Rodman and Malone? Neither.
Good answer.
I think Brock Lesnar looked at Karl Malone back then and said, damn, that guy's big.
I can be double that.
I don't know, man. Malone was friggin' huge.
Yeah, this is Brock Lesnar, though, man.
I think they're comparable. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think they're comparable.
We'll have to do a side-by-side. Let's get them in a room.
Yeah.
I like how during the practice, like, with all the media scrums, none of the players even knew where Rodman was. Phil Jackson just straight up said, I don't know where he is. He's not here. What do I care? It's as if it was, like, a normal thing that Rodman just didn't show up to a practice during the finals. And like, he was like, nah, whatever. Not a big deal to me. There's no way that any coach would be actually cool with that, right? Like, in the finals of all times? No way.
And MJ referenced it. You could sort of hear it as they were bantering in the practice. And he was saying, you know what, it's a pretty good payday for Rodman. And I think Rodman made $250,000 from the one appearance, and it cost him a $25,000 fine. So the math checks out.
Yeah, and he got his own plane, right? Like a chartered flight?
Yeah, and he got to hang out with Hulk Hogan all night, you know, having sixums. I mean, life couldn't be better.
Sixums. It was also jokes because Rodman showed up to practice and like he seemed to be always showing up in like these kind of like checkered pajamas.
Yes. The guy lived in those, man. After game 7 against Indiana, he was wearing those pants. He had the same pants on when he went to WCW and smashed Diamond Dallas Page with a chair. And then, yeah, you're right, back to the Bulls. He always had those pants on. What the hell? My man, do you own other pants?
Yeah, no, it was just funny to see him, and it's so in line with his character. And even when he was doing his interview now, talking about where he was during that time, like, he's wearing roughly the same style sunglasses, so, like, his style hasn't changed.
Yeah, neither has Mike's, though, to be fair. Mike's still wearing the same baggy-ass jeans.
Yeah, but Mike's living in fashion in the 80s and 90s.
I feel like if it was today, if that happened, if the Bulls were announcing the starting lineup, they do their, like, their regular, you know, running of the Bulls presentation, and then as soon as Rodman's name is about to get announced, they change the music over to the NWO's entrance theme. That would have been incredible.
Yeah, that's cool.
That song was just awesome.
Oh, it's going to be inserted. You know it is.
You should play it in this podcast.
I'm going to.
Before we start talking about it.
As soon as you said it, man, I knew it was coming. Have you ever...
New World Order.
Okay. Have you ever seen a team score 54 points in an NBA game?
Oh, my God. I actually watched that game when I was younger. Oh, man. That was like a JV team going against super athletic pros. It was weird to watch.
How is that possible? In the finals, too, nonetheless.
It's like the Monstars sucked out their talent before the game.
And left them with a JV team? Like, I don't understand.
I mean, you saw some of the highlights in that documentary. Like, Malone missed a 5-foot hook shot 4 feet to the right.
Yeah, was he
and
drunk?
They just couldn't gather any offense. Like, they're running down the shot clock literally every single play, and the shots they were getting, like, the quality of the shots were just absolutely deplorable. Then you see, like, Jerry Sloan after the game saying, that was a score? He scored 54 points in a finals game.
I think that was, like, the lowest point total in history, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think before the merger, yeah.
Yeah. I remember it must have been in, like, 06 or something. The Raptors scored 56, and I always thought that was the lowest point total in history.
That must have been during the Kevin O'Neill days with Michael Curry as a starting small forward.
No, that was... well, I don't know if that aligns with Rafael Arujo, but I remember Arujo being on that floor. I think it might have been 04-05 because it was against the Timberwolves. I remember Garnett being there.
Yeah, I mean, the Raptors played at such a slow pace, which the same idea as the Jazz that game. Like, they just couldn't get them in transition because they just couldn't stop the Bulls in the first half. And, yeah, the pace they're playing at wasn't the usual pace that they try to play at, which is more up-tempo.
Absolutely crazy. Raj, what did you get out of this Game 6 performance from Mike?
I think, like, again, I forget who said it, but it might have been the best 35 or 40 seconds by a player just to do what he did in terms of both on the offensive and defensive side of the ball, and to really to solidify his status as one of the best ever in 40 seconds. Like, you just saw who Michael Jordan was if you just watched that clip.
Josh?
Yeah, I mean, it also showed that the Jazz strategy when Pippen came back in the game in the second half wasn't on point, I guess you could say. I mean, he made some turnaround shots in the paint against Hornacek because, you know, Hornacek couldn't guard him in general because he's too small. But ultimately, they should have been taking advantage of Pippen on the defensive end because he wasn't so mobile, obviously. He couldn't bend over. And then offensively, when he was on the outside, they should have just doubled Michael every time.
Could you double in those days, though? I thought that was illegal defense at that time.
You have to go full double, no obviously. Hedging. You can't do what we do nowadays where you just sort of hedge.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that Pippen was that hurt. Like, I remember him being injured, but I didn't know it was to that degree where he could, like, what seemingly looked like he could barely get up and down the floor. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, you could see it all game, too. So you'd think they'd adjust their strategy just a little bit to say, you know, this guy really isn't an NBA player right now, you know? He can't move.
Yeah. Now it would just be, like, attack that guy at all costs, no matter what, until he's off the floor.
Yeah, you just have, you know, John Stockton running a pick and roll with whoever Pippen's guy was, getting him on a switch, and then just going to the basket every time.
Yeah, I guess it would have been Hornacek, right? On that team?
Yeah. Yeah. Or Byron Russell.
No, I don't think they would have done that with him. Sorry. Imagine Byron Russell going against Scottie Pippen one-on-one in possessions. Even with a hurt Scottie.
No, I meant just, like, bring him over as the pick guy just to get Pippen onto
But they didn't Stockton switch, though. Most of that defense was against switching.
The Bulls did a fair amount of switching depending on the opponent. Depends if they had like a really strong front court or back court. If they had a strong back court, they'd often switch because you had three guys across, you know, 1-3 with Harper, Jordan, and Pippen that could switch on anybody. And Rodman, too, when he played as well, depending on if they started Kukoc or not.
Yeah. Did Rodman play a lot in that series? Because I'm pretty sure he's really pivotal against Malone, right?
Yeah, because, you know, Kukoc can't guard him, obviously, and then Longley just can't get out on the jump shot, so Rodman was the logical conclusion to, you know, have him guard him most of the
game. Well, Longley would have matched up against Ostertag most of the time, too.
Yeah, but honestly, you could put Rodman against Ostertag.
Yo, don't disrespect Greg Ostertag like that.
Now, you want to talk about ugly haircuts. Oh, man.
It was the same haircut.
As Kerr? No.
Yeah, it is.
No.
Yo, Google that, man. It's the same haircut. Get out of here.
Ostertag was like the mohawk before the mohawk, where he didn't really know what to do with it, so he's just like, ah, screw it. I'm not going to cut the rest of it off.
All right, whatever you say, man.
No, it was nice just to comment on, like, Rodman against Malone. Remember when they were, like, battling and, like, Rodman and Malone, like, pushed each other to the ground, like, 3 or 4 times successively? That was just a good laugh.
And then they slapped each other's butts afterwards as if
nothing happened. Yeah, it was a weird relationship with Rodman.
It was so strange. Rodman did the, ooh, that one actually kind of hurt kind of reaction after Malone slapped his ass. I was like, what the hell is going on here, man? You guys are weird as hell. Such a Rodman thing to do.
Yeah, and based on Karl Malone's history, you would think that eventually he's going to hit him with an elbow, seeing as what he did to, you know, Isaiah and some other players back in the 90s. But it never got to that point, which is sort of surprising based on how physical they were. I guess they saved it for the WCW ring instead.
Yeah, he knew where the real money was coming from.
Yeah.
Yo, Raj, how would you feel if one of your boys, like the most successful friend that you have, brought you to celebrate with him because, you know, he had this crazy celebration and you had to listen to this dude play the piano and he was just awful at it?
Are you talking about Michael Jordan?
What would you do?
Yeah, I would listen to him because he's fucking Michael Jordan and I couldn't say anything. But any other person, I'd be like, yeah, like, let's move it for, let's keep it moving. But I think for me, like, the way he went about it, it almost seemed like a fairy tale. Like, he was playing a piano after they won the 6th championship, like, hit a game winning shot pretty much. There's a bit of controversy there with did he push off, but not really. And the piano just fits into that fairy tale.
Do you think he pushed off?
No, I don't think so. I think the momentum of Burrell, like, was just going in that direction, and did he? Russell. Russell.
Blame Burrell for everything.
Sorry, Russell. Like, I think his momentum was going that way. Definitely Jordan had a hand on him, but there, I don't think even Black Jesus couldn't move someone's body weight with just like a flick of a wrist. Like, you need to use your arms, and I don't think he really used his arms to push a 200-pound person out of the way a couple of feet.
I like how they edited what Isaiah said too during the commentary, because if you actually listen to the full commentary of what Isaiah said, Isaiah was basically saying it was a full push off and then it was totally illegal and the ref should have called it. And then they only caught the part where he said, oh, Michael's a killer, you can't let him ISO and take that shot.
No, they caught the, oh yeah, it looked like he pushed off, but the refs missed it kind of thing. It wasn't the, no, that was a straight up push off.
In the full commentary though, like, Isaiah said it a few times because you could just tell Isaiah was fuming.
Hey, don't knock Isaiah the commentator, man. Isaiah the commentator was great.
It reminded me of Mark Jackson the years after he got fired from Golden State, having to watch that team go to the finals.
Man, no. Isaiah never said hand down, man down, okay?
No, but you just feel the angst through the TV, you know? Like, ugh, again, I'm feeling this again.
Yeah, but Isaiah respected it. Come on.
No, Isaiah hated Michael, you could tell.
Still respected the game, man. Costas has come out and said that Isaiah never said anything that wasn't legit about Mike.
That's just because years Costas after, is a they were snake. Together. He's just trying to stay in the NBA circle.
Oh, the disrespect. Do you think it was a push-off?
No, hell no. Russell's momentum was going that way anyway.
Yeah. You don't think it was guided?
No. He didn't even extend his arm at all. Like, his hand was on his hip.
No, there was definitely an extension.
No, it wasn't a full extension. Like, the rule is you have to extend your arm in full for it to be a push-off, right?
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't that.
It wasn't I don't think it was a foul, but I do think there was a slight nudge or a guidance.
That happens every play, though. Direction.
Yeah, I'm not believing that, especially with the way his, wrist move. Like, it's really hard to push something that's 200 pounds. Sideways. It's not like he used his arm and his chest to push. It was literally his wrist was on his hip, and as he's crossing over, he touches his body, and yes, he might have tapped him or whatever, but I don't think he actually pushed.
Yeah, I don't think I wasn't saying it was a full-on push. I think it was more of a guidance. It's definitely not a foul.
Yeah, definitely not. I think it's a nothing call. I think it just is what it is, and you keep playing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think if it was the Reuter, the mailman, I think if he did that, you might believe it was a push off, but not Jordan.
Okay, what if Reggie Miller did that?
Ejection.
Well, Reggie just didn't give a shit. He just pushed off with two arms.
Yeah, and Reggie would never be going for a crossover either.
That too.
Reggie got to work those screens, and nothing else. Do you guys want to talk about the celebration at all?
We're not going to talk about the whole Reinsdorf and the seventh season. I thought that was the meat of the whole episode.
All right. So Reinsdorf obviously says that he offered Phil to come back, except he would have to rebuild. There was no way that he was going to surrender massive contracts to all the guys at their market value, from Kerr to Rodman, Harper, Jordan, Pippen. It doesn't matter who it was. Other than Jordan, he didn't want to pay to bring anyone back, and sort of just, left Phil in that position to decide whether he wanted to come back with the rebuilding team. Do you guys believe that Reinsdorf said this stuff? Like, straight up just said, I'm willing to bring you back, Phil, but I don't want to pay for anybody else.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, the big mistake was obviously with Pippen, because I think if Reinsdorf was able to restructure a contract with him and make him happy years before that, then it would have been pretty easy to bring the rest of the crew back, because you still have MJ and Pippen, and obviously you'd have Phil Jackson, as long as things changed at that point a few years prior, to where you bring those three back, and then you can give those other players, like MJ talked about, one-year contracts to come back and try to get another ring. So I think it would have happened a few years before that. I don't think it could have happened right after the season based on what had already happened.
Yeah, I'm going to go a different route, and I think what Reinsdorf said is probably how he explained it to Phil, and the fact that he just couldn't afford, quote, to pay those players like Steve Kerr, Rodman, Harper, the big bucks that they allegedly deserved, and of course they're reigning champions at that time, three-time champions. But I think he just showed that it really came down to money, and Phil Jackson didn't want to coach a rebuilding team. And I think the problem with Reinsdorf is they did a lot of damage, like Josh mentioned, with Pippen's contract before, and they did a lot of damage that year with basically bashing the team, saying this is the last dance, this is the last go, Phil Jackson won't be returning. And then it puts Phil in an awkward position. It puts like all the players in a tough position. So I think maybe they thought they weren't going to get that championship, but Reinsdorf really showed his true colors. And I think Jordan obviously looked visibly upset.
Okay. Do you think that the Bulls could have won a seventh if they had brought this team back or something similar to this?
Well, the season after was a lockout season, right?
Yeah. And then, so the 99 season, you have the Spurs and the Knicks in the finals, and then the Spurs win. So Tim Duncan's first championship, along with, you know, David Robinson and the cast behind them.
Yeah, so I mean, playing a shortened season with a, you know, very veteran team that's of the much older variety, I think, why not, right? Because you're getting a lot more rest throughout the year since you're not playing for half the season. But the only issue was, once they did come back, they're playing like three games in four nights, so they might have had to load manage a little bit if they could.
Yeah, no kidding.
But
as if Mike would allow for that.
Yeah, probably not. So I think they could have if they brought that team back. I mean, they're probably more talented than the Spurs team was back then.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm always very wary of this because I think part of the mystique behind Michael Jordan, like the basketball player, is that he went 6-0 in the finals, right? So what happens if he comes back and then he doesn't make the finals somehow? What happens if Rodman looks like he's barely holding on, and then, you know, the next year he goes to the Lakers and then essentially gets kicked off the team permanently, right? A lot of issues with this team. It looked like a lot of the guys had just put everything they had mentally into this last dance, and then that was it. Like, there's nothing left in the tank, basically, is what I've gathered from this team. So how can you, like, that's where I'm wary about bringing this team back for a seventh if, you know, they decided to go for it one more time. I don't think it would have worked.
Yeah, I think they could have won. I think their chances probably would have been the lowest out of any season, and probably for the same reasons you mentioned, just burnout and winning and finding that motivation. Like, who's Black Jesus going to get mad at this time? Like, the world for it raining one day? Like, it would have been tough, but I can't discount him, especially the lockout season. And if they brought back most of the cast, I think they would have been almost a guarantee to make it to the conference finals.
Yeah, but then even when you make it to the conference finals, you're going against like the Knicks all over again. Obviously, you know, Jordan's beat the Knicks like more than a handful of times, but it's still always an issue with that team where you're going against like a dominant big man. And then even if you get past the Knicks, you got to go against David Robinson and Tim Duncan. Woo, man. Even Rodman in his prime would have an issue with those guys. You know what I mean? Or like, I don't know, Luke Longley is going to have an issue. Bill Wennington going to have an issue. They would have just creamed them inside. At that point in the NBA, I don't know how Jordan would have done it again and again and again.
At the same time, though, like with the perimeter defense that the Bulls had, they could just swarm the Spurs. And the Spurs really had no outside options besides, I think if Sean Elliott was on that team, he was good, but he's not a guy you can really rely on for points.
They had Avery Johnson, man.
Oh, my God.
And Steve Kerr. How about that?
Steve Kerr's revenge, carrying Michael one more time. Huh?
Yeah. What team does Steve Kerr play for in this hypothetical?
It's a good question.
Yeah. And they have three-time champion, soon-to-be four-time champion, Will Perdue on that team.
Will Perdue's revenge.
Yeah. You know he would come after Mike. Maybe he just like fights Mike and then gets him tossed. How about that?
I still think the Bulls win, though.
Yeah, and I think also for me, like looking back at this documentary, I found an interesting point is how Pippen considers Krause one of the best GMs ever. And I think, of course, he's assembled one of the best dynasties in all of basketball and one that's always going to be remembered. And after all that Krause hate and how that season played out, at least he recognized that Krause did make some very good decisions, did help build one of the best teams, and Pippen is still reaping from some of the benefits of Krause's decisions. Maybe not financially, but winning six titles makes you relevant and gives you a job after.
You could probably make a really strong argument for Jerry Krause, though, right? I mean, six-time champion, pulled Scottie Pippen out of, you know, nowhere to get there to, you know, to bring him into the team. Obviously, he drafted Mike and then sort of assembled two different squads that three-peated. I mean, obviously, the rebuild didn't go as well as anyone thought it would, obviously, because, you know, how are you going to rebuild after Mike and live up to those standards? But, I mean, six-time champ. Not many GMs can say they did that.
At the same time, though, he had Michael. So, I don't know. For me, I would take RC Buford over him.
Just because of longevity?
Yeah, I mean, he built around a superstar for 20 years and didn't alienate him. And they made the playoffs all 20 years, and they won, you know, five championships. They probably should have won more if it wasn't for a little bit of luck going the opposite way. So, yeah, I would say RC Buford is probably the best ever.
I think luck going opposite way and their way as well, though, right? For the Spurs? Because you could say, you know, if Ray Allen didn't hit that shot, fine. But if, you know, we talked about this in like a couple of weeks ago, but if the Suns had beat them in 07, then they would have lost the 07 one. So it comes and goes. You can't really control that part.
Yeah.
True, but it's the fact that they were competitive and title contenders, you know, throughout, what, 10 to 15 years of that is pretty impressive.
In a dominant West, too. But again, just going back to Kraus, I think for me, like when I look back at this documentary, Kraus was almost in every single episode, and he was, in my opinion, a bit of the scapegoat for the reason why this team didn't get another go. But hearing the last 5 or 10 minutes really makes you change my opinion on who do I put the most blame on. And I think it has to come down to Jerry Reinsdorf, because he's the owner. He's the one that's really calling the shots. And of course, 6 out of 8 championships is an amazing feat, and that's nothing to look down on. But he also probably caused a bit of the demise.
I blame Phil Jackson for allowing Dennis Rodman to go wrestle in the middle of the finals.
Yeah, that was it.
Really blew up the team.
Lack of control.
Exactly. Phil Jackson. That's all it is. You guys got any final notes on this before we end it? What was your favorite part, quickly? You know, big or small, it doesn't really matter. What was your, like, the favorite thing that you saw or what you gathered the most out of, you know, that kind of stuff?
One thing I just want to bring up, do we actually think that Michael ordered that pizza and that it was poisoned? Or do we think that, going back to the gambling and the drinking, do we think that he just went out and partied? I mean, it is Utah after all at the same time. So maybe he went to like Vegas or something and came back.
Apparently Vegas is only a 5.5-hour drive from Utah.
Yeah, so it's not that far. That.
I could see it being a gambling inside the hotel room and then getting hungry situation.
Yeah.
And 5 guys showing up to the hotel room. It just seems implausible now that I think about it.
Yeah.
Why?
I think Michael Jordan was too well known for him to be just walking about in other places. And no matter if he went to Vegas or a local casino, and I don't think there's any in Utah, but like, I just think something would have came out, like a story would have been mentioned, someone would have taken a picture, like, this is fucking Michael Jordan, like, people recognize him.
Yeah, I believe the food poisoning. I wouldn't have believed that somebody did something weird to his pizza.
Yeah.
I'm just mad that, you know, Tim Grover or his boy George or whoever put their name on the pizza delivery order instead of, you know, a fake name like Steve Kerr.
Or maybe Michael Jordan is so psychotic that he told Ahmad Rashad to make him sick. So this could just add to his legend. Winning a game in that way.
What does that mean?
Like he's like, poison me so that I have the cards against me, so I'll be mad at the world so I can play even better.
He's just motivating himself in a different way, right? Instead of somebody talking smack to him, which nobody on Utah is going to do at that point. I mean, Byron Russell did it to him in his rookie season, obviously, but obviously not going against him in this situation. Maybe Michael just created a whole other edge in trying to motivate himself through, you know, food poisoning, the flu, whatever it was.
By getting himself sick?
This is conspiracy theory, Josh, right now.
Yo, that's
yeah.
Michael poisoned himself, man. Is what I'm saying.
Yeah, let's just go back to actually what we liked about The Last Dance, and maybe Josh will start his own podcast. But I think one thing that I remember about this podcast or this docuseries is I like the backstory. They didn't focus too much on the stats, which Michael Jordan obviously dominated in the playoffs, but they focused a lot on Michael Jordan's upbringing. They talked about Scottie Pippen, Steve Kerr, Phil Jackson, even Jerry Krause a bit, and to really get an idea of who these names were and who these players were before. And I thought that was the best part of the whole series.
I would say, not knowing that Rodman went to go to WCW after game 3, and just seeing him hanging out with Hulk Hogan. I mean, just seeing how Rodman just was always out there in the middle of the playoffs and games like that and still was able to play at such a high level really impressed me.
Man, I totally meant, well, like, from the whole docuseries, not from episodes 9 and 10.
I know, but even still. Okay. I didn't actually know that. Like, I sort of vaguely remember it, but just the fact in the finals, you have the balls to go miss a practice and then go on WCW and then hang out with Hulk Hogan all night, then come back and play as well as he did. That's impressive, man.
Yeah, I definitely remember him being in WCW at the time, but I never, like, it never clicked in my mind that it was during the finals. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the two timelines just never meshed in my mind.
But ultimately, in terms of MJ, the thing that stood out for me the most that I didn't really know as much was just how close he was to a security team. And just showing how isolated he was from the world throughout all the episodes. And that the only people that were really close to him were the people that were around him all the time that you wouldn't really think he would be in contact with. Because maybe, you know, a lot of people, when you're at that level, you're not going to pay attention to the smaller people around you, right? The guys who don't get paid as much that are just there to do one small job. But just the fact that, you know, his best friend is a security guard. And then, you know, a second father figure, which I'm not sure what happened to him afterwards. He ended up dying, I'm guessing, after they won the third title, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So I didn't know that, obviously. And then obviously the other security guard who had the mullet, that was pretty funny as well.
Yeah, that dude ended up being the security guard for his home in Chicago. John Michael Wozniak, I think is his name.
Yeah,
he was like the main security guy for the Chicago home.
That's amazing.
So Mike kept all these guys around like after he played too, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, so I mean, just him not really having any normalcy and, you know, regular friends outside of the people that just, you know, sort of grew their relationship with him just based on having to be there with them, just based on their job. He didn't really have any normal friends outside of that, it seemed like.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. I know that, you know, we've always heard the stories about how much of a maniac he is, like how much of a ruthless competitor he is, how much he loves to gamble, but yeah, you rarely hear about how he takes care of his people like that. So, you know, that's a really nice point of the story to hear. I like seeing how badass Mike is and then, like, just how cool he looks every time. You know that image in your mind whenever you hear about Jordan picking a fight with a player on the court and he's just got, like, his finger in the guy's face yelling at him? That's got to be my thing. I just think, like, Mike is a badass dude. Or when he's in the locker room with his baseball bat, talking about BJ Armstrong, talking his shit with a cigar in his mouth. Being like, yeah, it's easy to talk when you're on top, but man, wait till we're tied starting the next game. Then we'll see. All with a baseball bat in his hand, like fake swinging it. It's just a cool ass image, man. Mike is a cool dude. The whole time I was just waiting to see when we're supposed to hate the guy. When I don't think at all anyone hates him after those docuseries. I think Mike's legend is just going to live on even stronger than this.
Isaiah still does.
Okay, other than the Bad Boy Pistons, I don't think anyone hates Mike.
Again, I agree. I think Mike just showed why he's the best and the most, like, I guess, lovable player, and maybe not like in terms of who he was all the time, but overall, like, him being a winner, him pushing his teammates, him being good with the media. He just did things his way, and he was cool about it.
Yeah, good with the media until they accused him of having his father killed. Up until then, he was great, and then he just sort of said, screw you guys, I'm going to do my own thing from now on, which I don't blame him for. All right, and I think that's all the time that we've got for this week. That's it for the Traveling Cocaine Circus, guys. We got to go back to finding other basketball content now. How about that? Last Dance is over. How do you feel? What are you gonna watch now?
I'm gonna watch Raptors Sixers Game 7 tonight.
just relive the relive.
Yeah.
I mean, after seeing, you know, parts of that game seven between the Bulls and the Pacers, that got me motivated again in terms of watching basketball.
Raj, what are you going to watch now?
I'm probably going to watch something not basketball related, probably Billions. But if I am going to watch anything basketball, this kind of makes me want to watch the Iverson documentary just because it was the same director. So maybe I'll check that out.
Yeah, that one's supposed to be really good.
The Clippers documentary with Donald Sterling is coming out today, too, on Quibi, so that should be interesting.
That's another Chris Paul production.
So. And it has to be good.
Yeah. It might end poorly, though.
Shut up.
All right. I want to thank everyone for listening. Please remember to rate and subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, Anchor, iHeartRadio, all the major podcast platforms. You can hit us up on Instagram and Twitter at Stretch4Pod. And until next time, peace.